Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We're glad you are tuned in. We continue today with Connie Ellis's reading of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly, a novel about a handful of people in a northern Minnesota town. We pick up now where Connie left off last time.
Chapter 12. Peter had his Saturday morning to himself. Nat had vanished into the music room to plan the music for rehearsal and to proofread the sheets for each chorister's folder. Outside the huge study room, the night snowfall lay about the glade that Peter Tenebrae, like his dad and granddad, kept between the forest and the short back lawn. Before the first oaks and one basswood tree stood a deer lick and a bird feeder whose wobbly saucer-shaped guard had never defeated the most thick-headed squirrel. Most early evenings, Peter and Natalie brought their drinks to the big study window. Several times they saw the huge mother bear they heard about. First they thought they saw her with two cubs, but apparently she had only one. Her large tracks lay here and there amongst smaller creatures' tracks, this morning showing up in the snow. Peter sat happily, genuinely happily, at his desk, his thin mug of morning coffee on a pewter pad on a small side table. He came from a line of men who had the luck and sense to retire at 60 or earlier. He was only two-thirds retired, of course. He did any work John Rubric gave him, kept it, along with school, old boys' correspondence, in the exquisite little drawers and cubbyholes of the desk. St. Fursey Vestry meeting minutes, however, he, from time to time, took over to the church itself. He filed them in the undercroft. They joined the long record of Tenebrae family members' work as senior wardens. All the notes to one or another rector, all the minutes, all the handouts to the vestry, hard work, all that. He would put it at the front of a file case whose file drawer, those furthest back, had minutes and correspondence kept by his grandfather. Records of jobs his friend John Rubric had brought him, speaking to civic groups, watchdog groups, the occasional gatherings of one or another corporate director. He kept at home. He was delighted he had the talent John loudly admired. Thoreau was right. Most people's work, and non-working hours as well, were brutish and nasty. Peter's weren't. His life was wonderful. His desk had been his great-grandfather's, the Rockefeller model. Peter set himself happily to this morning's work. He liked being able to see the guest wing lying to the north. Its beautiful stonework half-framed his view. The four-generation Tenebrae house was not made of brick like other Minnesota mansions of the 1890s and 1910s. It was a stone mixture of roseate and gray stone. Each stone had been custom cut into one of four different oblong shapes, then fitted so exactly that the house could nearly have been drywall work. The masons Peter's great-grandfather brought over from Cornwall didn't merely lay level courses of stones and then fit the ends. They blocked the walls, custom-fit vertically as well as horizontally. The effect never failed to delight Peter. He was grateful for the security and leisure in his life, but a close second feeling was the enjoyment of beauty around him. Too bad he was likely the last paterfamilias for the family. He firmly told himself that if he felt wistful about the death of his infant grandson, poor Imogen must feel it 1,000 times more. The Tenebrae men had always had the knack of happiness in their home study. Peter, like the others, kept the operations office in Hibbing, in the Tenebrae properties office in Duluth. In the St. Fursey house, therefore, the only papers lying about, the only books in the handsome anteroom off the sitting room, were private work and leisure reading of his own, as he had done several times in the past 2 weeks. He glanced up at the desk's beautiful gallery. An accident had broken some of the decorative gallery, torn all three hinges away from one cabinet. Poor Arlene, who cleaned for the Tenebrae's as well as for Doc Anderson and the Episcopal Church and St. Fursey Elementary, was the most considerate creature in the world. She sometimes came to work bruised, Peter hated to open the door to her and then covertly see, as he picked up and read Nat's list of instructions on the sideboard, that one eye was sometimes blackened. One cheek black and blue. It pained him. There was nothing you could do, of course, about the quarreling between husbands and wives. He knew that wretched axiom well enough. It was now several weeks since Arlene had missed her step while working in his study. He had been waiting for her to finish. He had hoped to speed things up by telling her to by no means try to do anything with his desk. He heard a horrible crash and a woman's outcry. She had tripped and in falling had grabbed the open cabinet door of the secretary and yanked it out. "Your beautiful desk," she wept. Natalie came in from the music room. It was only 10 or so in the morning, so she wasn't tight. "Nonsense, Arlene," Nat said briskly. "Those old desks, something is always happening to them. And look, all that's happened here is a small matter of one hinged door. Easily fixed, Arlene." "She's right," Peter came in promptly. "This desk spends more time at the repair people's than it spends here. Don't worry about it at all." "You know what central heating does, Arlene. It dries out houses so everything breaks like matchsticks." She was consoled. Peter had called down to his dad's favorite restoration place in St. Paul. He described what damage he could see. No, he didn't want to arrange to ship it. Would they come up and fetch it with their van? He would have a boy here to help lift. Good enough. They talked it over. The restorer said she was pleased she had a beautiful stick of walnut already on hand. That was one good thing. Might run over something between 2,000 and 2,500, including travel. Might be more if she found dried and loosened veneer, say, on the raised panels or anywhere. She had a record of that desk in their shop. Mr. James Tenebry had once had a part of the gallery replaced and carved. "It'll be your call," Peter said. "Whatever it takes, I've loved that desk since it was my grandpapa's, and I wasn't tall enough to see over the top of it." It was back now, and he was grateful. All the 3 weeks it was gone, Arlene had over and over told Natalie and Peter that she couldn't think what was the matter with her, that she didn't think to tell them that her Brad could have repaired the desk for them. That was so dumb of her, she said, and Brad would have done it reasonably, too, because he'd mentioned different times maybe getting into the furniture repair business. He couldn't decide between furniture repair and automotive. A job like Mr. and Mrs. Tenebrae's would have helped make up his mind for him. It was so dumb of her not to. This morning's work was especially pleasant. It fell right down the center of Peter's best capability. He therefore made himself take care of a small, dutiful note to an Andover classmate first. He sometimes felt chaffed that his schoolmates didn't originate many letters to him. Why not? Why didn't they? He was a good correspondent. Perhaps it was that their lives were busier than his. Even when his class had long since left school and graduated from their colleges, Peter had not had to work the extraordinary hours that his friends reported in the class notes and in their Christmas letters. A family business was not a law firm. No heartless eagle eyes had ever watched Peter for billable hours. Peter hadn't much to report about family affairs. Imogene was born, grew up, married, had one child, not three or four. Peter lived in the old family home, not an Ohio cornfield converted to a suburb. For sadnesses to report, he had only a grandchild's death. Natalie and he were battling her drinking problem, but a drinking problem is not fighting cancer, and in any case was unreportable. He gradually grew hesitant about starting up any correspondence with men who had shown no interest in hearing from him. It would not be pushing, however, to come up with an annual Christmas letter. Besides, he knew exactly what a Christmas letter should be. 3 to 5 paragraphs, warm greetings, personal news of the last year, but reporting only surgeries or internist diagnoses that led to happy endings, with a final paragraph expressing worry about the times or the world, but no specific mention of the United States. In fact, never put that phrase, the United States, into a Christmas letter. This morning, He meant to give a moment to a man who had sent what was frankly a form letter to all of his classmates. Peter couldn't recall his name. He consulted all 8 of his huge but tidy mailing lists and couldn't find him. He had even looked up Bennett Solutions, the man's employer, on the web, but its restrained homepage in deep red and a lighter orange didn't link you to a list of its officers. Peter felt he must reply, if only out of plain human sympathy. The man had written, without a complimentary heading of any sort, "I will be stepping down from Bennett Solutions." From there, he went into his appreciation for having worked with remarkable colleagues who provided him with intellectual stimulation and so forth. At the end, he said he intended to spend some time to find the right context in which to develop my range of options. Peter shook his head. The phrase was a soundless scream. Language gave away a person's pain. Transition, an expression used in the classes part of the Harvard magazine, meaning someone's husband has done a bunk. Now the ex-wife was in transition. The right context in which to develop one's range of options meant any lead, please a job, any job, please. Dear God, classmates, please a job if you hear of anything. Peter thought it all over and decided on brief and respectful. He found half-size letterhead in the second drawer, decided against using Tenebrae Properties letterhead, fumbled for personal letterhead, and wrote dear. He had to look again to write, remind himself of the fellow's first name. Dear J, very, very best luck with all of it, and signed the letter Peter. Then he underlined all twice because he meant it. Then he added a P.S. This is the darndest economy. At last, Peter was free to attend to his morning's tasks. John Rubric had asked him to talk informally with the executives of a smart little wholesaler who had been watchdog for renaming and continuing to sell a carcinogenic ingredient in soft drinks. The company very much hoped to keep on using this ingredient because it apparently was just addictive enough to make young people ask for that soft drink by brand name without attracting notice. So far as their marketing people knew, from anyone connected to the FDA, so far they had only citizens activist groups to deal with. The company couldn't have to worry about these groups so long as they did not appear to be planning to join forces with one another. John and Peter agreed on a 2-page solution. First, they must heal the PR lesion caused by the watchdoggers. Next, they should gauge how intense and how durable would be the memory of the issue. That is, if the company recovered its prestige or even took steps to improve it, might they again rename the chemicals in question and use them again? Peter began drafting out a rough syllabus for himself. First, the company must address the legal necessities. Second, but close to the same time, of course, because it should start immediately, the company should develop a handsome reputation of a kind to kill adult idealists' interest. They needn't look more attractive to the teenagers drinking the stuff. They might be well advised to work up a little new advertising about how this beverage caused weight loss. If you shouldn't lose weight, consult your physician before imbibing. Peter scorned that particular strategy. He had been shown stats for how well it worked, however, so he didn't quarrel with the pros. One of the noticeable markings of his work was how much conciliation or tolerant turning of a deaf ear one must do. He complained once, just once, about it, years ago, to John. "Well, but you are good at that," John had laughed. John made it sound as though Peter did nothing but soothe criminals or the like. "Nonsense," John had said. "Peter, ask yourself, why does this company want to hire you to preserve their public esteem for them? Because you get along with idealists, idealists like you. You also get along with the Fed, and then, very talented of you, you get along with the kind of CEOs who know that in the end they will have to do with it whatever it takes. So why not start with bottom-down strategy right now? Save a lot of time." Peter shook his head, but he gave his friend a friendly smile. John said, "Well, people like your moral taste." Peter began to divide the papers about this morning's job into 2 piles. the company's central and peripheral memos, the public response to company policies. He read over their January annual meeting booklet. John Rubruch had put a post-it on each of the stockholders' proposals and on the company's responses to each. There were only four for the most recent annual meeting, all of them from Roman Catholic nuns with their order initials after their names. The meeting editors would have weeded out all other complaints on the same page, so that an average reader saw only that bunch of nuns. Wouldn't you know? What did they know of the necessities of business? Were howling about something again? So what else was new? Peter had been around stockholders too long not to know that a good many sensible businessmen complained in their own minds about evils that only the Catholic sisters criticized aloud. So he did not sneer at the letters. He read each one through. He was already seeing how his timing might go. First, some modest publicity, friendly projects, high school lyceums, town library talks, then giving some words to the wise, identifying who was likely to promote a serious campaign against the company, and seeing what might palliate them. All that would give him time to design a change of general attitude. For example, if you were selling beverages with aspartame, at a time that looked bad in 1994, but by 2006 or 2007 had gotten screened back out of memory to just one more carcinogen among millions. The best thing to do with protesters who were young is offer to meet with them and tell them the company had had to go back to the drawing board. It was costing them money, they would say, showing some slides, but we don't want that kind of thing. The young people would feel they had won. Last time, Peter had conducted a program like that. A number of 20-year-old men and women had later got into a queue up to shake hands with him afterwards. Now Natalie interrupted him. She put her head around the door and said, "Bernie Stokowski's here, and he didn't ask if it was convenient. He's out of uniform." By leaning forward, Peter could see about half of the driveway turn around. The parked car was a Ford, not the town patrol car. He stood up and went out into the living room. Bernie Stokowski was removing his snowy boots and letting snow melt pool onto the gray and olive vestibule tiles. He wore reversible woods clothes, orange side out, and lifted a large pack sack that Peter hadn't noticed right away. "Hi, Bernie," Peter said. "Hi, Peter." The man glanced around the living room with a speculative look. Natalie had disappeared into the music room. "Have a seat," Peter said. "How about coffee? I've got it all set up and just have to turn on the maker." "That'd be good," the cop said, brightening. "Well, sit down, Bernie." "Say, Peter, this is private. Do you want to..." Again, his eyes moved toward the living room. Peter told him Nat was working on the violinist bowing in the music room. "Would Peter's study do?" He pointed. "In there," he said. "I'll just turn on the coffee." As he went into the kitchen, he thought, "What's this going to be? Man wants advice about something. Wife? Gladys?" He didn't think so. Peter knew that people sometimes regarded him as a community sage of some sort. They asked his advice on the damnedest things, but not about wives. Job? No, Bernie's kids were too young for him to be looking around for job contacts. Wanted to turn Episcopalian? Wondering how to do it without tearing the family wide open? People thought one thing or another would tear the town wide open, or it'd tear the family wide open, or would tear the United States wide open, but it never did. Anyway, only eager churchgoers switched passionate loyalties from one church to another. Casuals, as Peter understood, Gladys and Bernie Stokowski to be. Maybe Pearl the accompanist was in trouble again. Perhaps Bernie wanted to know if Peter by any chance knew where she went after she closed down the VFW. He shuddered at the thought of where all she might have gone. He returned to the study and saw the strong cop sitting on his grandmother's needle-pointed chair seat with its glorious gross point of pink and lighter pink azaleas. He fervently hoped that Bernie had come to him on his way to go hunting and not on his way back with blood and mud and snow melt on his trousers. "How can I help?" he said simply, hands half opened and out over the papers that covered the whole desktop. The policeman gave a nervous laugh. "This time it's me helping you. Let me tell you this way. I'm going to tell you from the beginning, because you'll get the point. But Peter, please believe me, this absolutely has to stay between us too. I wouldn't tell you at all, except that I think you have a right to know. Not a legal right, some kind of other right, I mean. I just think you have a right to know. Peter waited. So you don't pass any of this on, Bernie said. I don't pass any of this on, Peter said. Wait a minute, Peter added. This will take some time. Let's see if the coffee's done. How about I defrost and microwave some very good leftover deli sandwiches that Nat and I brought home a few days ago? Bernie smiled. Yeah, he said. Sounds good. But Peter, would this be a thing where your wife will see that we're eating and want to come join us? No, Peter said. It's a promise. He went fast into the kitchen, heated the sandwiches, filled his own cup and a clean one for Bernie, put paper napkins on a tray, and brought it all in. He set it on top of his work on the desk. That's really good, Bernie said with his mouth full. Peter saw it was going to take forever for Bernie to get going with his story. He settled himself and glanced out the window. Peter himself ate enough of the sliced ham, sliced Swiss, sliced red onion and mayo Dijon to make the policeman feel at ease. He slowly drank coffee that he also didn't want and waited. Bernie began to talk. He started way back. His father had been the chief of police in St. Fursey and Culla both a long time ago, when he was just a little boy. Like any child, he hadn't known the ins and outs of his father's work. He had admired the man. From really his childhood, he had loved it when his father lifted him up, when first coming into the house out of the cold. His uniform tunic was cold, and the buttons were icy. His father's face shined red and smiling. Years passed. One early fall day, Fort Leavenworth sent a calling all cars that was picked up by every cop in northeastern Minnesota. One of their most violent repeat murderers had escaped and was believed to be heading north on U.S. 61. Bernie's dad gathered his wife and children, tucked them into his car, and drove into the Superior National Forest, Tui Lake, a beautiful place that Bernie never forgot. They were camped for a few days. Bernie's dad told him how to tell the straddle of a mouse's track in snow, how to tell if the mouse was trotting or galloping. He showed them a woodpecker's hole in a tree, lifting the smallest child close. He explained how the woodpecker dug the hole on the underslant of a tree trunk on the south side so that it would get sunlight and warmth, and when it rained, very little runoff went into the bird's cozy home. Their dad and mother cooked them fried meals. Bernie was charmed, and his dad insisted on doing the dishes, a job his mother normally did. His dad trotted around in the fire-red light and near dark of their campsite. He talked to himself, locating what he needed in the dark, telling the dishes, stay there, don't fall off, don't go away, all in very good humor. The little boys could see the shadow of their mother with her flashlight inside the family's heavy canvas tent. They were longing for her to be ready so they could get out of the heavy, languid, dark cold that had come down on them. At last she called them in, made them take off their clothes and put on their clean underwear, which she had warmed for them under her jacket. They smelled of wood fire and of her. She put them into one of the serious goose-down sleeping bags where she had put hot water bags filled with boiling water from the fire. Bernie had thought he would never be so happy in his life as he was that first night, just before sleep, watching his mother as she moved things around in the flashlight light, listening for his father, who was still clomping about outside when the boys fell asleep. He did not find out for years that the reason his father had taken them winter camping all of a sudden like that was that he was afraid to try to pull in a repeat murderer. Bernie got into a fifth-grade fight with a boy who said his father was a coward cop. From then on, he knew what the town knew. Everyone in the county knew. A state patrolman from way west of Bagley had finally apprehended the murderer, so the countryside was safe again. It was safe, but never again the right feeling to Bernie. He grew up and became a policeman himself, like a lot of people in their late teens and early 20s. He just wandered into a kind of work, got some training, and took the job they taught him. Police work, in his case. One day, he was upending a couple of beers with old high school classmates, and someone said, "Going to be a cop, huh? Way to go, Vern. State Patrol." He did not want to try for the much-coveted State Patrol. He wanted to work up to be Chief of Police of St. Fursey. Once he actually noticed that, he set down his beer can and thought, "Of course, what I want to do is do well what my dad did badly, not to show him up or to compete with him, but to recover his good name, our good name." Still, Bernie told Peter between mouthfuls of sandwich, he wasn't a very good cop at first. He arrested everything in sight. He all but brought in turtles for crossing the white line. He wanted to find crooks here and felons there. Finally, he settled down. Now Bernie Stokowski paused and said, "You must be wondering when I am ever going to get to what I want to say. I'm getting there, Peter." "I'm listening," Peter said. He added, "I am not in a hurry." He had been longing to concentrate on his job notes. He had been sorry that this earnest policeman showed up. However, he shut it out of his mind, because any fool could feel the urgency in this man's unburdening himself so strangely. Peter felt a spark of pride, too, that an upstanding member of the local police, the chief himself, needed his help. Bernie picked up his story with the finding of last Friday's dead body alongside Highway 53. Right away, Bernie told Peter he had scented large-scale crime, or part of some large-scale crime, not just some crack-trashed serial killer. He wanted more luck than he'd needed before. This was trouble from far away, which meant someone knew exactly what they were doing. What's more, this someone had enough money, another way of saying enough personnel, to carry off any crime so simple as a single corpse murder. People came from Duluth to identify and study the crime scene, but left again. Bertie remarked to Peter with a wry smile that they haven't even stayed long enough to have donuts with the locals being him and Darryl. Darryl, Peter thought, oh yes, that unpromising-looking deputy policeman. Bernie said, "So, I told Darryl that Homicide and Duluth would be doing the investigation. I needed to have Darryl think that, because although those officers, two cars of them, whoever they were, handed the PM over to us and asked us to ask our ME to send in the results, they left us the body. They said they would fill us in on whatever they found. I said, okay. I saw that Doc Anderson did the body in Culla Hospital. When they are set up for examinations, Dr. Anderson wrote out his PM. We sent it into Duluth. We never heard anything after that."
You've been listening to episode 15 of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. This book will run for 20 episodes through July 23rd. If you miss a day, remember that all the week's episodes are posted on our website, ktwh.org, on the Literally from the North Shore page, on the program's drop-down menu at the top of the homepage. Be sure to tune in again for the next episode of Shelter Half. The piano music filling out these Shelter Half episodes is performed by Robert Ellis, our reader Connie Ellis's husband, from his CD, Moonrise.